I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Andrew H.C. McDonald. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you.
Our listeners will be very interested to know that Andrew and I are here to talk about his first published novel, The Montegiallo School of Swearing. A great Italian word, Monte. Mountain Giallo Yellow.
Mount Yellow. Well, there was I had quite a few choices of that I wanted for the name, but they all were taken. I wanted Monte Rosso at first, but there's a very, very famous Monte Rosso in Italy. There's Montazzurro. They're all sort of taken as you might expect. So Monte Giallo, I think it's a hiking mountain, but it's not really a famous town or anything. But I'm fine with Mount Yellow to end up on.
Well, it suits the book. I loved it. Let me take this position straight off. I just loved it. You made me laugh out loud. The first couple of chapters just set the story up and I couldn't put it down. And I kept reading. I realised I wanted to buy the film rights. And this would be described, I'm sure, as a stunning rom-com once it goes to the cinemas, Andrew.
Well, I hope. I originally started it as a screenplay and then I thought, I'll write it as a book instead. And then, you know, if it was going to work out that way to make it a screenplay. But it's a pretty visual thing. I worked in film and TV for quite a long time, so, and I'm a visual artist as well, so it is quite a visual sort of text, I think.
Well, you're obviously a creative person, but I'll just read to our listeners the bio on the Fremantle Press website that accompanies your book. Andrew H.C. McDonald was born in the small town of Shackleton in the wheat belt of Western Australia, moving to the foothills of Perth at an early age. He has been a photographer, a comedian, storyteller, and is well known as a visual artist, particularly as a printmaker, and currently works at Curtin University.
All correct.
So you've sort of been through all of that, building up for this book, I can tell, Andrew. How long did it take to write?
I was trying to write it in the free 30 days of Scrivener novel writing software, but I didn't quite get that. So the initial draft of about 45,000 was about 38 days what it took, and the editing has taken about a year and a half.
Well, I can see that once you got into this, you could just see the next chapter opening up, tell our listeners, in the appropriate, not giving away too much, although telling them it's a stunning rom-com, they've probably worked out something. But in your own words, what do you want them to understand happens in the book?
Okay, so if I was doing the elevator pitch, it would probably be a broke Australian causes chaos in a tiny Sicilian village when he teaches the locals how to swear like an Aussie. That's the, as I say, the elevator pitch. But it's sort of more about the rom-com side, the masks that we wear with language and clothing as well is a big part of it as well. So it's sort of about that too. The swearing side, even though it's in the title, is not the whole book. So it's, and a lot of that takes place later in the book as well.
So who would you want to play the leading lady and who would you want to play the leading man?
I had ideas of faces that I had was thinking of, and not, they're not necessarily actors and things that are right for it now, but might have been in the past. I had an actor in mind that, so my brother is a playwright and actor in Melbourne, and there's one of the actors he uses, Phil McInnes, that I had as who I was thinking of. He's been in a few things. There's a guy who was in a Kerry Packer sort of a World Series biopic that I just have pictured for Toby. I think for that you have to have a face in mind. Elizabeth, one of the early female characters, I saw a face on an advertisement and I thought of her as that face from there. Viviana, she's a cross between, I guess, Gina Lola Brigida in the 50s, and my mother, who had a similar sort of look at the time as well. So I had faces in mind, but not necessarily who I'd be wanting them to play it now.
It is interesting because everybody, when they read a book, depending on their age and experience and their favourite movies or television series, imagines this person or that person playing the roles. Why Sicily?
Because it comes up every couple of years as a new story that this €1 scheme, you can buy an old Italian place for €1. And it's been going for decades in different parts of rural Italy. But when I was researching how it actually worked, the only place that I saw at the time was in Sicily, central Sicily. So I went with that. But, you know, it's something that quite a lot of the rural towns in Italy are suffering the same sort of thing, where the young people have gone and it's beautiful, but no one lives there. In fact, it got copied by, I'm from the wheat belt myself, as you said, it got copied by Bruce Rock in the 1990s as well, a dollar for a plot if you paid the rates and things like that. So that's why I chose Sicily in that instance, but it has been across many parts of rural Italy over the decades.
Well, as I said earlier, the first couple of chapters just completely hooked me. The dialogue between our two characters was fabulous. He's suddenly saying that he doesn't know what to do with himself. His marriage is at an end. The apartment they used to own is about to be settled. He's one deputy Victorian Teacher of the Year.
It's a runner-up, and that's rankles as well. He didn't quite win it.
Yes, runner-up, you quite get it. He's not sure. And then his mate Toby comes in to intervene, takes him out, and they get mightily pissed at margaritas or something. And then he discovers, because he's so drunk in the morning, that he's signed up for this property, and he has to decide what to do. Well, he does the sensible, logical thing, Andrew. He goes, has a look at the house in Sicily.
Well, I'm not sure. I think some people would have the fantasy of doing it, but that actual spur to having done it is quite a big leap, because it's not as simple as just paying the euro. There's quite a lot of things that are involved in it that you have to do as if you want it to actually happen. I think having that way of doing it as they didn't know what he was doing because he'd had a few too many, just to push him over that line there.
The books that deal with this sort of topic, but in different ways, Peter Mayle's A Year in Provence is famous, made into a television series where basically document in a fictional way the trials and tribulations of fixing a house up. You don't quite get into that, although there are moments when that happens. But it seems to me the book has, as you've intimated, a lot to do with human relationships. He discovers a treasure trove of clothes. It's like discovering what's out the back at a theatre. He starts wearing the stuff, taking on new personas, is reinventing himself to an extent.
Well, I think people, particularly here, sometimes in Australia, and well, a lot of places in the world, men particularly don't make much of a, don't see clothes as a thing, you know, particularly here, you'll have guys going out to show or something in thongs and shorts sometimes. I mean, it's not a valued thing here. But the transformation power of clothing is really, really huge, and you can be a different person putting on different clothes, a suit, and I would definitely have been wearing that suit that he finds.
I could never quite pin it down as to exactly what era it was, and you occasionally would give some hints as the novelist, and later in it, one of the characters sort of, I thought, pinned it down to the 40s, but I'm not sure. But it was interesting because Viviana, as you say, she comes across as this Gina Lollobrigida type character. And yes, the interplay. But the other interplay was, as happens, there's all these expats. They've all turned up from all these rich, basically European type countries, the US, England, this Australian, and they don't always hit it off or try to hit it off with the locals. Did you have anything particularly in mind for the setting?
I think a lot of times those expat, there's stories of the British in Spain and all that sort of thing, where they have the British pubs and all, they do tend to stick together and maybe not learn the language, and they're there for the sun and, basically their own lives in a sunnier place. And I think that is still true in some places. Italians don't make it any easier for them either, but it is a thing that expats in some of those sort of situations will have their community and perhaps not step out of it as much as they should, particularly most of them are a little bit older and they're maybe a little bit less adventurous.
They certainly seem to be very comfortable, although you think if you're adventurous enough to buy the €1 home and spend money doing it up, you might be a little more adventurous. But I have to say, over the years, when I've been in little Italian towns, the first thing I do is tell them in my best Italian, such as it is, that my name's Michael and I'm from Australia. It immediately dispels the idea I'm a rich Americano.
Exactly. Well, you have to do that. And also, some people are not, you may have experienced themselves, just talking louder in English. You can do at least buongiorno, come on. And I've had the experience of, if you make attempt, even if it's bad, people absolutely love it and they will really warm to you. Maybe not the same in France, but in Italy, that is the case. If you make the effort, then they will make that effort too.
Now, for you, it seems to me you had a clear idea what you wanted to achieve here. You wanted humour. You'd worked out that this was, in the end, going to be the rom-com. And it's nicely done because you don't have long chapters. Each chapter is almost a scene from a movie. But what were the challenges in taking the idea and writing it into practice?
I was able to write it so quick because I knew exactly where it was going to go and I knew every single scene. So I was doing a couple of thousand words a day, sometimes easily. The challenges were, my Italian swearing had to be proofed by a professor in Melbourne. Okay, so there was a little bit of backwards and forwards. She didn't like some of my swearing that I'd found on the web, and we had to just find exactly the right phrases that were funny and not too nasty, but just the right side of funny and, absurd. And so that was one of the challenges. My Italian is about the same level as Brian's in the book, which is...
That's pretty good.
Mediocre. I can talk and ask for things and things like that, but all these years, when you do learn at school, which he did, same as myself, you do remember a lot of the stuff when you're young, so I still remember that. I have the same Italian book on my shelf still.
Well, I wondered where it was going to go with the swearing, because it starts off with a proverbial fuck, spelt in Italian in a very long way, but the one that surprised me, I thought, oh God, did he write cocksucker? Well, did he?
Yeah, well, yes. So, but I think also, because swearing is so interesting, because a lot of in English, a lot of the terms, particularly sexual ones, they're all people good things, and a lot of them are they don't have a meaning except for the emotion you're putting into it. So I think, when you're doing it in a different language, it is a very different thing because you don't have all that. It's just two or three bare syllables sometimes. And I think that's what I found interesting as well, that it gives you a freedom without the baggage of what those terms mean.
That was the really interesting, for me, psychological study in the book, where people, the Italians initially, the Sicilians, we shouldn't just bang them in with all Italians, sort of freed themselves by taking on words that they didn't really understand, but they learnt the phonetics and they were well taught by Brian, and with sort of gay abandon, away they went, walking down supermarket aisles and relieving themselves of their burdens.
Well, I think, Some people ask me, would you think it could work for real? And I think it could. If I saw signs at the pub saying, learn to swear in German tonight, you know, $15, I probably would go to that. I mean, you know, it's...
That'd be a lot harder than Italian.
I guess so. But it's really interesting, like in the... I also speak bad Chinese as well, and one of the strongest insults is turtle in Chinese. And, you know...
You turtle.
Yeah, turtle is bad. You know, to call someone turtle is a serious insult.
Very
but,
careful.
You know, again, it doesn't have a meaning except for the emotion you put into it. And if you don't have that emotion, it's... I think that's, you know, a lot of the book is about that, how those... how language works, I guess.
What are the messages? I mean, there usually is a message in a book, if not three or four of them, that you want. It might be that you want different demographics within your readership to receive different messages.
I just wanted it to be funny, really. So I wanted it to... As the world we are in now, I wanted Monticello to be a place where people could go, where the problems are serious but absurd rather than existential, which, you know, the rest of the world is at the moment, where people can go to visit, and it's a place that's going to be funny. It's, you know, in the end, it is a joyous sort of book, despite the title. So I don't know if there's any message as such. I want to have a funny, enjoyable, interesting book that can take people's minds off of everything else that's going on in the world for a little while.
Funny, interesting, and enjoyable. Well, I can endorse that. Having read it, as I say, I really am saying this for the third or fourth time, but I really did enjoy it. It might be that it was for precisely that reason. So going from Trump trying to kidnap Canada or Greenland, or you know, endorse the dropping of more bombs on Gaza or some other crazy thing, you pick this book up and you in a sense escape with it for a short while. Let me ask you this. You've had all of these interesting creative lives, and you've mentioned stand-up comedian. How does that experience play into the book? Was it very direct?
Well, I just was reviewing all the things I've done, so visual artist, stand-up comedian, writer, and, you know, it just only really just struck me how they're also intensely individualistic things, a photographer as well. Mm. So I don't know why that is, but stand-up is such an interesting thing to do, and having done it, you know, can speak anywhere on any topic without feeling nervous and things, but it's such a direct, and it's all you, it's just you. If it fails, it's all yours. If they laugh, it's all yours as well. And writing is individualistic as well, but I was not aware of the vast number of people it takes to get the book actually done. You know, so the Fremantle Press have been absolutely fantastic. Editor Georgia Richter, just brilliant. But so many people have marketing and design and typesetting and editing and all of that stuff. It's going to be audiobook too. Writing is individualistic, but book writing is a massive team.
I'm always amazed when I go to the movies, and I usually stay to the very end of the credits, how many people go into making a movie. And the book's the same, as you say. You write a manuscript, people review it, editors edit it, then it has to be put together, has to get a fabulous cover on it, and it has to be given a title. And I love to ask, writers, to what extent was the title workshop? Did you walk in with that, or did Georgia say, let's come up with this one?
We talked about it. I think, I thought first maybe that it gives it away a little bit, but it's not just about that. But I think signalling that it does have a lot of swearing in, even though it's a very light-hearted book, I think we decided that it was a good idea that people understood that at the beginning, rather than have it as a surprise that comes up. And I think it probably was the right choice. In fact, 99 out of 100 things that our editor said were all correct. Probably 100, but you've got to push back a little tiny bit sometimes.
Did you hear that, Georgia? It works because I was puzzled by the title, and I think, well, yeah, good. And I get into it, and all of these things are happening, and personal challenges, and the relationships are nice, leaves the country, gets to Sicily. And I know it's basically called The School of Swearing. I thought, well, there's going to be a twist, though, in the tale. It's not probably what I read, or whatever it is I'm thinking about. And then suddenly it happens, and it happens very, very naturally. And you're hoping he's going to succeed, of course. You want him to be able to fix up the banister rails in his apartment and all of that.
The B-Day,
sort
of course, the B-Day.
The B-Day.
The B-Day has a starring role in it.
Well, and gold toilets and things. I mean, it's just wonderful. So the title's there. It intrigues you, and then you get into it, and it's just vital. Are you ready for your second one?
I was going to see how this goes first. I've got a couple of other ideas as well, but I want to see how it all goes. And every single experience has been like, you know, I have no idea how any of this works. So I'm learning each of those things, which again, Food Metro Press have been fantastic in. So once I know how it all works next time, I did 15 drafts before I sent it to Food Metro Press. And there was many, many more after it, but there was things from that editing process that I would know to do differently or have already done when it came to that point.
Well, Georgia has co-authored a book on how to be an author and how to get your book printed. So what is it that you've learned in the process that you would be happy to convey to another starting out person, both in the writing process and advancing it?
Okay, so if you have to have someone else to edit it. And if you are not going with a publisher, it's worth paying someone to do it. And there's probably going to be 1,500, 2,000, somewhere, something of that nature. You have to have someone read it because you cannot, being inside it so long, you cannot see what it requires. And there was a couple of scenes, Georgia made me read Pride and Prejudice again. She's saying there's a scene in there that's missing from here. And it was exactly so. That's why I think self-publishing is fine, but you would need someone to, an expert reader to look at it. Plus with self-publishing as well, there was a couple of legal things in here that I didn't understand either. You can quote the title of songs, you cannot quote the lyrics without paying, which I had no idea about. So there's all those sort of things as well to learn the practical things about it too.
Well, what's this going to do to your career? Are you now abandoning everything and going off to a mythical Montegiallo to start writing full time?
Be like, I want to be David Niven signing off on Wounds of Balloon, Cap Ferrat. So, you know, maybe if I can sell a few books.
Sign off Montegiallo.
Yeah, so like I work at Curtin and it's quite a stressful job. But I'm not giving that up at the moment. So I think also from this process and marketing people and all that we've had meetings of, most people do not sell many books. And even the number that you would sell to be a bestseller, however that's defined, is not enough to live in Cap Ferrat, that's for sure.
Final question. I'm totally intrigued. Andrew H. C. McDonald. Is the H. C. a literary flourish, Andrew?
Well, my parents experimented on me because I was the first born and gave me two middle names. So I thought that I would make use of those in my creative endeavours as well. So I'm putting them in there. So yeah, they haven't been much use before then. So the Hugh Christian is what it stands for. I'm making use of those two letters now.
Andrew H.C. McDonald, thank you very much for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.